Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Well, everybody's supposed to be equal when it comes to the law, but some lawyers are arguing that the concept of reforming legal aid so that poorer people can't afford the same access to justice puts that very principle in jeopardy. This week, we're discussing legal aid.
The overall effect will be to achieve significant savings while protecting fundamental rights of access to justice.
Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
£2 billion, that's what the legal aid budget was before the reforms, and £350 million, whilst it seems like a lot of money, is in fact a drop in the ocean. So what exactly are we trying to achieve? Is it better justice or simply cutting costs? It's a bit of a dilemma faced by politicians of all political parties and hues, but there are many arguments that, frankly, people are being put at jeopardy when it comes to all sorts of access to justice, whether it be criminal law, family law, controversially, there are some fairly big reforms, human rights and prisons law. So before we get going, let's bring in guest of the week now. Emma McClure is a paralegal specialising in human rights. Emma, tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I did a master's degree in human rights law at university and I got really interested in it. But to fund my studies, I did a couple of years working in various parts of the civil service until I got my job now working in civil liberties, and that involves sort of judicial review work and largely prison law.
I think as a former civil servant, you're probably used to a judicial review or two, Emma.
Yeah.
So, look, in terms of legal aid, from your perspective, I mean, you work for a large Northwest law firm. You do all sorts of areas of law. What's the feeling towards it in legal circles? Is there an acceptance that, frankly, the budget is bloated?
Not at all. I don't think the budget is bloated. I think that we should be proud of the system that we have. The fact it's so expensive is because it was one of the best justice systems in the world. The $350 million that you refer to is the amount that's just been cut from the civil budget on the 1st of April. And then they now want to cut a further $220 million from the criminal budget.
The question is whether it actually saves money, and we'll get into that a little bit later. I think it'll probably help if we set out the stall a little bit. So let's take a listen, courtesy of the Ministry of Justice, to the Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling, setting out the argument for reform.
Really three parts to what we're trying to do with our legal aid system. Obviously, a big focus on bringing down cost, but also, I think, on building confidence in the system. So the first of those three is about who is entitled to receive legal aid. And what we're doing is we're closing off our civil legal aid system to prisoners who are complaining about conditions in our prisons, to people who've come to this country and lived here for less than 12 months, particularly to try and close off access to our civil legal aid system to people who are illegal immigrants, to people who are failed asylum seekers, or people who've just even turned up on a tourist visa. So that's one part of the change. Second part of the change is to try and make sure that our system actually is one where people pay for what they can afford. And so we're raising the bar financially, so more people will have to pay for their own legal aid if they're earning well above average income, if they can afford to do so. That's important. We're also looking in the longer term at a way of possibly recouping much more of our legal aid costs and our court costs from people who commit offences when they're young and actually in later life are earning plenty of money and can afford to do so. So that's the second part of our change. The third part of our change is all about making the system more affordable for the taxpayer. We've actually got the most expensive legal aid system in the developed world. I mean, by comparison, France spends around £400 million a year. We're currently, even after the changes we've made in the last few years, spending £1.7 billion a year. So there's going to be big changes to what we pay out in terms of the amount we pay to solicitors, in terms of the amounts we pay to barristers.
Justice Secretary Chris Grayling there explaining some of the legal aid reforms, and by his own admissions, it's cost-driven at least to a degree. picking up specifically on the point that Chris Grayling makes there. He says he wants to take civil claim legal aid effectively out of the hands of prisoners. But actually, as we'll hear a little later from Andrew Sperling from the Association of Prison Lawyers, it's not quite as simple as that. Do you think that the cuts are necessary or purely ideological?
I think that they're purely ideological. The point, he wants to remove prison legal aid from everything except parole matters and things to do with disciplinary hearings in magistrates' courts. But those cases, he's talking about treatment cases, there are already very few of them. Since July 2010, I think only 11 of them have been granted permission.
All right, we'll hear about some of the permission stage and from the prisoner's perspective and prison lawyers in a little while. But this has obviously received quite a bit of opposition in Parliament, and with the other side of the offence as far as equalities, at least, and the voluntary sector, advice sector is concerned. Let's take a listen to the Labour MP for Makerfield. Her name is Yvonne Fauvargue.
I'd like first to turn to the comments by the Secretary of State, who said this isn't an attack on women and children. This is an attack on fat cat lawyers. Well, perhaps you could tell that to the 1,000 people who use the services of Bolton CAB for specialist welfare benefit advice over the month of January alone. Or to somebody like Jeannie, who emailed last night, extremely pleased with the result in the Lords, and saying that perhaps now people like her can leave an extremely dangerous situation and receive the financial help and the support to do that before they're murdered. The changes to the legal aid system will have a destabilising effect on the funding of advice agencies, law centres and CABs. Hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions, lose out. There is a disproportionate effect of the funding cuts on the not-for-profit sector, which the government's own impact assessment agree. They receive 77% of the cuts to civil legal aid. And advice agency funding, as I've often said, it's a bit like a game of Jenga. It's complicated, it's interdependent, and small amounts removed can lead to the whole structure coming crashing down, leaving the vulnerable clients underneath with nowhere else to go.
Do you think it's a fair point, Emma, that vulnerable people are the hardest hit by these reforms?
Absolutely. I mean, vulnerable people are also then people least able to sort of represent themselves. And, I mean, the civil changes from April, there's not been that much time, but there is anecdotal evidence that the number of people having to represent themselves has gone up, and that incurs extra court costs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, I'll tell you what, some of the areas that I don't think are overly affected is advice at a police station, and that's when somebody, they're guaranteed their rights under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984 for free and independent legal advice. There's no particular talk of that one changing, but there are all sorts of reviews in terms of the thresholds when it comes to trials and the like. But could it not be argued to a degree that a financial cost is in effect punitive and a punishment in itself pre any conviction?
Yeah, absolutely. If costing someone money before they've been convicted of something would go completely against justice anyway. And just to go back on what you said about the right to representation at the police station, the proposal to bring in competitive tendering is going to have a very, very negative effect on
so-called PCTs, isn't it?
Yeah.
And let's just quickly again summarise what that might mean. Someone would have to have a contract with them, or they'd have to be assigned from a central point. You couldn't choose your own solicitor if you found yourself on the wrong side of the law. Touch wood, I haven't as yet. But I think to a degree you can't, you know, take those relationships forward. And to a degree, this comes down much more widely, actually, to the idea of disenfranchisement, the idea that in America, obviously, there are public defenders who are widely regarded, even though some of them are very good, to be fairly awful. It's almost taking choice out of the hands of the individual.
Yeah, that's correct. You take the choice away, and there's then no incentive but for the representative to do the very best job because they're not developing any kind of sort of commercial relationship.
We're chatting with Emma McClure, the legal paralegal, focusing on human rights as a specialism, and we'll come on to some of those issues in a little while. But let's take a look now, after someone's been arrested, or summons for that matter, convicted of a criminal offence, sentenced to prison, but maybe they've got particular gripes. At the moment, Chris Grayling, the Justice Secretary, is saying that it's kind of outrageous that people in prison who are there to be punished are able to take taxpayer-funded action. So I kind of put to Andrew Sperling from the Association of Prison Lawyers, from Scott Moncrief & Co, the idea that the public might be uncomfortable for legal aid for lags.
Well, I understand that people have concerns about prisoners getting having lawyers, and I understand they have concerns about prisoners getting legal aid. And I think it's really about what that legal advice and assistance is for. It's quite right that people should ask questions about what taxpayers' money is spent upon. I believe very strongly that it's spent on the right things, mm-hmm. And that there are lots of checks and balances in place to make sure that that happens. But I think that what one of the main concerns that I have is that the proposals that we're going to be talking about today are very counterproductive, and they won't reduce costs, they'll in fact increase them.
Talk us through those proposals.
In relation to prisoners, prisoners receive legal assistance at the moment for a range of things. One of the particular changes that are being proposed now is that areas outside of parole hearings and disciplinary hearings, lawyers provide advice and assistance to prisoners, will be removed completely, and that if prisoners have particular concerns about legal issues in those areas, and I'll give you some examples in a moment, that they are that they go to the complaints procedures, so that prisoners won't be able to have lawyers to help them, they'll have to use the complaints procedures. If those procedures worked, that would be fine. I have very strong views that those systems aren't particularly helpful for the kind of problems that that will be removed from legal aid.
But do you understand that many listeners to Hear Here will have, you know, literally boiling blood at the concept, the man on the Clapham omnibus, if you will, the idea that someone's been convicted of a serious criminal offence, yeah, because that's why they're in custody and not on a community sentence, that they should be entitled to taxpayer-funded advice?
I do, and if it's for things that are that they consider to be trivial, then my answer to that would be that those cases don't get legal aid. If somebody, the kind of cases that get reported a lot are actually civil claims, and the kind of claims that I'm talking about are issues about which are about rehabilitation and resettlement. And the current Secretary of State for Justice is very keen on rehabilitation, is very keen on resettlement for prisoners. And by removing legal aid for assistance that lawyers provide, legitimate assistance that lawyers provide to those prisoners, they're actually attacking the prospects of rehabilitation and good resettlement for those prisoners. If prisons didn't make decisions that were unlawful, then there wouldn't be the need for lawyers. And the fact that that people make wrong decisions, they might not do it deliberately, but they make decisions. There's a legal framework for those decisions to be made in. And if they make wrong decisions, then prisoners should be entitled to be able to represent themselves. Now, if prisoners were across the board articulate, well-trained enough to be able to do that for themselves, then fine, they wouldn't need lawyers. But there are an enormous amount of prisoners who have learning disabilities, who have mental health problems, who are not particularly intelligent. There are some very, very intelligent prisoners, but some of them will need some assistance. And if that there is a genuine need for it, there is a genuine legal problem, then they should be able to have that.
Okay. Well, now, obviously, one of the things we've been speaking about in Hear Here today is you know, pre that process, when somebody actually finds themselves possibly under arrest, summons to a magistrate's court, appearing in the dock, as it were. But essentially, I suppose your end of it, prisoners. Also, if the Ministry of Justice make a decision that needs to be judicially reviewed, this is another area you're concerned about.
Again, this is another situation which there's a lot of misinformation about. The government's paper talks about trivial cases and fails to mention there's a very strong check and balance within the system already. There's an agency called the Legal Aid Agency. For a prisoner or anybody to get legal aid funding, they have to make an application. The Legal Aid Agency is independent of lawyers and has to make a decision about the merits of that case. Is there a good enough case? What the proposal is that for in cases for judicial review, I'm going to try and make this as straightforward as possible, but relatively complicated in some ways. But the basic point is a public authority may make a decision which affects a particular person. So we're not just talking about prisoners here, we're talking about ordinary members of the public. Everybody will be used to councils making decisions which might affect them. They will be used to, for example, if they are affected by decisions of the UK Border Agency, they may make a decision. Or their government agencies, the Department of Work and Pensions, they might make a decision. If those decisions are wrong, then a person would want to challenge them. Now, it's a difficult process, and the reason that there are lawyers there is that lawyers understand, or are supposed to understand, legal processes. For judicial review, you have to get past a kind of hurdle, first of all. It's called permission. And so you have to be able to convince a judge that you have an arguable case. Now, in order to do that, lawyers will prepare a case and will present that to a court, and a judge would consider the papers before them. Now, what the government is proposing is that that lawyers shouldn't get paid at all for any of the work up to permission. Now, some of those cases will involve hundreds and hundreds of hours of work. If lawyers are not going to be paid for doing hundreds and hundreds of hours of work, unfortunately, they're not going to be in a position to do that.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo. Sign up for your free account now.
And you can sign up for your free account at audioboo.fm. You can listen to this show at Hear Hear Show. And if you haven't done so yet, it's disgusting. You need to subscribe to us on iTunes. And that way we drop straight into your podcast app each and every week. Also, if you like the show, you have a duty to like it on Facebook and share it. Tell your friends on Twitter, Tumblr, all that sort of jazz. Make sure you spread the word like the plague. Now, that was Andrew Sperling from the Association of Prison Lawyers and Scott Moncrief's and co-solicitors. Now, that's the unpopular side of legal aid from a public perspective, I think you'd agree, Emma McClure?
I do have a hard time sometimes convincing people my clients but, are worth the money.
But some of the aspects, you know, human rights specialist as you are, you'll have followed some of the aspects in terms of immigration, withdrawing legal aid from anybody who hasn't been in the country for 12 months. Now, on the face of it, from a layman's point of view, that might seem quite a sensible measure.
Well, there's lots of problems with it. I mean, to follow on from what Andrew said, obviously there are some people who are in prison who are from foreign countries and they wouldn't qualify, and their representation problems are compounded by the fact that a lot of them won't speak English or find the system difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, if you remove the residency condition, people who are wronged by the state in other countries, for example, sort of Iraq and Afghanistan, they won't be able to obtain any recourse from the UK government.
All right, well, that's a fair enough point as well. And now, we were talking earlier about the PCT, the effectively contracted lawyers at police stations and the like. The danger is, of course, that it can become a bit like a sausage factory and a bit commercial. I understand Eddie Stobart, the trucking company, are looking to get in on the action.
Along with other companies such as G4S and Serco, who already run some of our prisons, which is quite convenient for them. And there are 1,600 firms in the UK that provide criminal legal advice, and that's going to go down massively if these proposals come in.
Now, talk to us a little bit about that. There are various considerations about people's financial means if they apply for legal aid, aren't there?
Some of the proposals are that if someone earns over £37,500 a year, they won't be entitled to any legal aid at the police station. It just impacts on people's access to justice.
I suppose it could be envisaged that somebody might refrain from taking much-needed legal advice just on cost-saving grounds. But we'll come back to a little bit more of this in a moment. The other thing I asked Andrew Sperling about from the Association of Prison Lawyers was what this would do to the legal profession.
In a way, there's two professions. I think lots of people presume that all lawyers are the same and that legal aid works very differently from the private commercial market. So the stories you get about fat cat lawyers and about the amounts of money that lawyers get paid, bear absolutely no resemblance to the kind of pay that people get for legal aid work. And again, something that probably a lot of people wouldn't be very aware of is that people who do legal aid work, not only as their pay rates not increased at all for 15 years, but they've progressively gone down. So there's already been a whole range of cuts, and we've got to the point where legal aid work is not done at all anymore for significant profit. There's no money to be made in it. But the problem is that these proposals will remove the last vestige of expert lawyers who are prepared to do the job and do a very, very good job for people who really need it.
Let's play devil's advocate for a moment, because the Secretary of State for Justice, Chris Grayling, Ken Clark before him, speak about the enormous amount of money we spend, that's you as well, by the way, out of our pockets to fund legal cases. And he compares it to the rest of Europe. You know, France is about £1 in every 23 with conversion. We're sort of closer to £1 in 7, £1 or £8 here. It's a lot of money. Can it not be reformed at all?
It is a lot of money, and yes, it can be reformed. I mean, there are two issues particularly. First of all, the cost and the funding issues in relation to legal aid are always analysed without looking at the entire system. So, for example, the French system has an inquisitorial system. Inquisitorial is a posh word.
Roman system of law, as it were.
It's investigation. So, for example, the French criminal system judges do a lot of investigation work. Mm-hmm. In Britain, we have an adversarial system. Mm-hmm. So the judges very much take an impartial role and they let the defence and the prosecution present the case. So, for example, the court budgets in the UK are much lower than the French budgets for the court system. So a lot of the work that French judges do, investigation work, isn't done in the UK system. So it's like comparing apples and oranges. They're not comparable. But the other point is that we really have, we should be proud of our judicial system. It is admired across the world. And I think people within government would agree that it's a fantastic thing that we have a great legal system, which goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think what they don't realise is that what they're proposing is very likely to destroy that. Now, it's not going to happen immediately, but it will happen progressively over time. And handing over the judicial system to large private organisations who have to make a profit and have to make a significant profit to keep going is very, very dangerous.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Well, Andrew Spurling there, still with Emma McClure, the human rights paralegal. I think there's a picture that some politicians like to paint of fat cat lawyers, and yeah, I think the public might have a bit of sympathy with that sometimes, but it's not necessarily the case, you would argue, Emma.
Yeah, I mean, I would have sympathy with it if it was true. But, I mean, the truth of the legal aid profession is people more like people like me. I mean, I live with my parents through financial necessity. Another factor that these changes don't take into account is that they are going to massively damage the social mobility of the profession. You're going to end up with in a situation where the only people who are able to enter the legal profession are those who come from wealth.
OK, one of the areas we haven't really discussed is family law and the idea of taking legal aid away from, you know, things like divorces and that sort of matter. And of course, they do cost an awful lot of money, divorces. But there's also a bit of an impact potentially on sufferers and indeed alleged sufferers of domestic violence, Emma.
Absolutely, because the changes mean that you need to obtain proof of domestic violence before you're able to access legal public funding in family cases.
What sort of evidence is acceptable?
A GP's letter and things like that, which cost money, which people...
Yeah, I mean, see, this is what I couldn't get my head around because, you know, particularly these days, there's an awful lot more awareness of the idea that domestic violence can be physical, but it can also be sort of mental. It can be through the use of words. And if nothing else, are we not going to see an increase of allegations of domestic violence, whether warranted or not, so that people can qualify for effectively what it is becoming, at least in terms of perceptions and the way the rhetoric's going from the Ministry of Justice, being perceived as some kind of welfare, and again, lumps it in with the rhetoric about sponges and the like?
That's possibly a risk of it, but I imagine the allegation would still need to be backed up by evidence, which is going to be difficult to obtain.
OK, well, just give you the last word on the topic of legal aid. Your message to Chris Grayling on legal aid, if you had 30 seconds with him, what would your message be?
I would tell him that my clients are far from too thick to pick, that suspects are only criminals after they've been convicted. And in relation to family law cases, I think that the protection that professional legal help gives to those who have been suspects of domestic violence is too vital to get rid of.
Emma McClure there, the human rights paralegal. Thank you for joining us on here. Joined in the studio now by Audioboo's James O'Malley, presenter of the Pod Delusion. Legal aid, it's, you know, I'm talking from a layman's point of view. It's quite a hard one to get your head round, isn't it?
I'm certainly struggling with it and I'm trying my best to understand. I've been listening into the fascinating discussion.
It is important. I think sometimes in terms of impact assessments, it's important, you know, from a governmental point of view that the law of unintended consequences doesn't prevail. And, you know, the message I'm getting loud and clear from lawyers is, look at this one again. Now, you know, if you're going to press ahead, press again, but look at it again and don't rush it through.
I think it's one of those things that politicians approach completely differently to other people because it's a bit like with, say, drugs, where you've got to look tough.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you approach it with a cooler head and think rationally about these things, you've got to think, oh, hang on, maybe we should be a bit more careful.
I think the problem is people, you know, hear legal aid, they don't think necessarily judicial reviews and they don't think somebody's been treated unfairly, you know, a civil wrong, a tort, as it's known in civil law. They assume criminal. Now, I guess that's half the problem. But James, you're with us now to have a chat about some picks of the week. But you're the presenter of The Pod Delusion. That's available on Audioboo. Tell us about it.
It's a weekly news magazine, radio programme and podcast about what we call interesting things. So we cover everything from politics to science to culture, all from a sort of sceptical rationalist point of view, if that doesn't doesn't sound too pretentious. So we tend to sort of ask the difficult questions, trying to say, well, what's the evidence behind this claim and stuff? You know, and we try and keep it a bit lighthearted.
And you have some blooming decent guests on there as well, haven't you?
Yeah, we've been going for 3.5 years now, and over that time we've had all sorts of people on the show. We've had David Attenborough on. He's probably our biggest, most exciting name, and I can tell you I was nervous when I interviewed him. We've had Armando Annucci, the creator of Veep, the creator of Alan Partridge, which is quite fun because we're recording in the
Alan Partridge studio. How funny is that?
So that's brilliant. And we've had loads of sort of people from the world of science and that sort of thing, so all number of interesting people. What's great about our show is we literally run up to people at events with microphones and get them to say things to us.
Hey, doorstepping, it's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. You can listen to that here on Audioboo. Remember, you can get your free account at audioboo.fm. If you like here, it's really important that you give us a mention on Twitter and on Facebook. Help us make this mission work. Look, your picks of the week, you wanted to kick off with the G8 in Ireland.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a global governance nerd, so I find international summits and sort of thing fascinating. So the two stories from the G8, I mean, apart from the important official agenda discussing Syria and all of that, apparently, David Cameron gave all of the G8 leaders a playlist of young British artists on a USB stick, which, you know, just goes to show how sort of trendy he is. But if he was really trendy, he would have given them a link to his Audioboo account for them to listen to him there. But what I think was really fun about this is that imagine you're Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia.
I'm imagining it.
Exactly. And you've just seen in the news everything about this mass surveillance, GCHQ, the NSA, PRISM and all of that. And then David Cameron hands you a USB stick. Do you think, yes, I'm going to plug this into my computer? I don't think I would if I was him.
I don't think I would either. Mind you, if I were Putin, I'd probably think we might have that information aside anyway. But there we go. Okay, now that's not the only pick of the week.
Can I mention a couple of things?
Yeah, you mentioned anything
so
you like.
The other thing I thought was fun about the G8, and I'm not sure how well this works on radio, is there was a picture tweeted towards the start of the G8, which was David Cameron giving a press conference, and someone took a picture of all of the major political editors, and it just sort of showed the lack of diversity in amongst political reporters, because it was Nick Robinson, it was Adam Bolton, it was Tom Bradby and all that. They were literally all wearing those sort of very stereotypical cream long coat. It just made you think, well, they really do. They do look all the same.
Bring back Laura Koonsberg from ITV's business editor's position, but maybe the next BBC political editor. You never know.
Absolutely.
You never know.
And the other story I wanted to mention is it's maybe a bit old now, but Bilderberg, which was last week. Yeah. I mean, it's been...
We discussed it with Colonel Bob Stewart on our defence special. Oh, for goodness sake, Sean, he said. He said it's just a private meeting.
Well, this is what's really interesting. Though it's very easy to laugh, and I've been amongst the people enjoying the Bilderberg conspiracy theorist.
Alex Jones.
The likes of Alex Jones.
From Infowars.com!
That's a good impression.
It's not bad. I've been interviewing Alex for years, actually.
Really?
We should get him on here one day.
You'd have to turn the microphones a long way down, I think.
Yeah.
But
this is freedom!
But it's very, very enjoyable to watch the likes of Alex Jones talk about how, you know, there's chemtrails or they're putting cancer into vaccines and so on. Whilst I, you know, obviously know that's nonsense, what I think is interesting about Bilderberg is that there is a genuine concern, which is almost being hidden, which it is this sort of lobbying meeting. You do get these influential politicians and these influential business
leaders. Yeah, the idea is supposedly to improve US and European relations, but you get sort of David Petraeus, who left under a cloud, of course, in the States, and they're effectively, you know, defence contractors and that sort of thing. And I guess from a transparency point of view, forget the idea of lizards, you know, metamorphosising into, I don't know, donkeys or whatever the conspiracy theories are, or some of the more wild ones of, you know, waving their private bits of each other. I've heard that one. At Infowars.com! But actually, there is a fair point. How do you know what happens there if it's not so untransparent?
I mean, it's exactly the same. The way we should be worrying about meetings between David Cameron and Rupert Murdoch, and the way, you know, whenever that's uncovered, it's like, oh, why didn't anyone tell us about that at the time? Mm. We should, you know, maybe we should be asking questions about what's going on at these lobbying talks. I don't think that they're stitching up planning who wins elections. Mm. But at the same time, if they're going, oh, well, maybe you should, you know, maybe we'll donate to your campaign.
Yeah, but these meetings, they happen. Rupert Murdoch does meet with people, and he does promise to, you know, the Sun what won it and all that stuff. And actually, I've always been of the firm belief that it was never the Sun what won it. It was the Sun what guessed it, you know?
Well, they've always gone after winners. But my point is that if, in any other circumstance, a government minister was to meet with...
Defence contractors.
Exactly. You'd at least want that recorded somewhere So there'd be some sort of oversight.
Hang on a second,
something.
James.
Sorry.
Did somebody say Adam Werrity? You were saying?
Well, I think that proves my point, Sean.
Yes, indeed. Well, this has been Hear Hear Special on legal aid and, of course, other matters. This is Audio Boo's new weekly political and current affairs programme. If you've liked it and you don't stick it on Facebook or Twitter, we're going to come and see you, so help me God. In the meantime, we'll be back this same time next week, same bat social media platform.
Hear Hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.